This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined again by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have three sponsors for the show. The first is Jam Software, second XMA, and finally Squarespace. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, good evening. How are you?
I'm good. We are in the, the thralls of Christmas program rehearsals. Mm-hmm. So if any of you folks that run IT and media at your school, you know that you are sitting in your auditorium for many, many hours, clicking buttons and buttons and buttons. One of the things I'm running into is it appears that iTunes has removed the feature for gapless playback by controlling that. So it has to, like, basically if you import a CD, it has to, like, tell iTunes at the time of importing that, hey, I'm gapless. And you can burn them as gapless CDs. And so what we're running into is I've got some tracks that we need to make gapless that doesn't seem to be possible. But as we found, we were listening to it, and it sounded funny, but as the kids are singing along, you can't hear the gap. So I think we're okay. But it's just interesting that used to be a feature that you could control and edit, and now you cannot.
Yeah, iTunes is iTunes going to iTunes, I think, is the way that's going to go, isn't it?
Well, iTunes is what it is, and there are a lot of complaints that people have about it, but I don't know ultimately what a great solution there is. I found that just using it for music works fine, mm-hmm. and I know there are situations where people try to upload libraries to iCloud Music Library, and it has eaten them for lunch because of like a lot of custom rips they've had.
Yeah,
but I don't sync my devices to iTunes anymore. Everything's over the air. I use Apple Music, and it's fine. And I've been thinking a lot about like what is Apple Music and iTunes versus like Spotify. And I would say if you're someone that wants just the simplest streaming solution you can get, just like all you can eat music, Spotify is by far simpler to use. Mm-hmm. But if you're the type of person who wants to combine your existing library with streaming music as well, well, iTunes is really your main option. And then Google Play Music is also a good option there. But, there's no native Mac app. I think there's some third-party apps. But I think most people in the Apple ecosystem are picking Apple Music versus Spotify. And, there's a lot of legacy involved with iTunes. And I think Apple, and particularly Apple fans, are kind of having to eat their own words mm-hmm. on calling out Microsoft over the years on not being able to cut stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not that they don't want to, it's that it's very difficult because you have these existing ecosystems, and it's not even just about there has to be iTunes on Windows. Like, I don't think it's even just about that, is that it has to do a lot. And I don't think Apple is at the place where they're ready to say, you can no longer sync iOS devices with the Mac. And I think maybe one day that day will come, but I don't think, that's ultimately, so what do they do? Do they have 9 different apps for managing iOS on the Mac, or do they have one?
Yeah.
Both of them have their positives and negatives.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's tricky because, you see the benefit that Apple got from taking photos and making it a completely new thing from the ground up, and how elegant that solution is and how reliable it is for most people, versus what's happened with Apple Music, where they've kind of jammed it into both the music app on iOS and iTunes on the desktop. And I honestly, personally find Apple Music very confusing overall.
It's particularly confusing on the desktop. The iOS is much easier to navigate. Mm-hmm. One of the crazy things is like when you do go to search for an artist, if you're somehow into the store, if you click like the iTunes Store tab, it opens up this whole new world. The search is to the iTunes Store. But if you're like in your library, you can say, hey, search my library or search Apple Music. But I think to me, the issue with a ground-up iTunes rewrite is that it would not include any sort of app management or syncing. It would just be for music. And I don't think they're at the place where they can say, no app management, no book management. Of course, the books are in iBooks as well. And maybe that's what they do. They can kind of – maybe they have separate applications. They could have like a videos app, a music app, a photos app, a books app. But then there's kind of like this central, iPad or iOS sync app that just handles the syncing. I don't know. It's a problem to solve. And it's something we face a lot in schools is mm-hmm. the integration and lackluster experience, or great experience but segregated products that don't talk to each other. And that's something that we constantly battle with here, and I battle with in my mind, is does the integration with a possibly worse experience, is it worth it?
Hard to say. I mean, Apple Configurator could be that sync engine, you know, at some level, but Configurator is a pro tool. You know, it's not something you're going to put in the hands of people. But I think, I mean, you got to realize that there are still probably hundreds of millions of iPods in the field that people still actively use. I mean, maybe they have a secondary role now. Maybe they're devices that go in a car or something, rather than being, you know, my primary thing for listening to music on. But of course, you've got all those iPod Nanos and things, and iPod Shuffles that people are kicking about with to do exercise. And you know, because we're so kind of smartphone centric and iPad centric and things like that, we may think that all of those other use cases are dead, but there's just so much legacy hardware in the field that it's, you know, I really think that bringing up something on the side that only did the new thing, you know, say there was like an Apple Music app that basically did nothing until you were signed up for Apple Music, but when it did, you could play your music. And then people say, oh, it's so confusing, there's two music apps, and okay, fair enough, but I think build for the future, not for the past.
Well, and I think when you reference the fact there are so many legacy devices Apple must think about, that again is exactly where Microsoft was for all those years, when it was like, oh, they just need to clean up their code. Well, it's hard. Like, it's not as simple as like running script that says clean code. I mean, Ben Thompson's talked about this, I think, quite a bit, either on his website or on his podcast. That it's not that Microsoft didn't want to do these things. It's just like there is no one path on how to fix a lot of these things. I mean, Photos was easy. It's like, take your photo library, make it be everywhere. Like, that conceptually is an easy product to envision. What does syncing of iOS devices to a Mac in an iCloud-centric world, and if the future of the sync is not with a wire, what does that look like? Like, and how do you build that for the future when in reality that product shouldn't even exist in the future?
Yeah, I mean, but I think that what that would do, and I think the great benefit of doing that, Bradley, would be that if, say, Apple came out and said, okay, iTunes is end of life in 2018, right? And literally, we are going to discontinue everything to do with iTunes, and you better sign up for Apple Music, or you better, you've got 2 years to take on iTunes Match, and then we're going to take away that version, and then you'll just stream the whole lot. That would also focus the iOS developer's mind and say, well, okay, we don't have this crutch of just plug it back into your Mac and do that, you know, recover your iPad that way or back it up to your Mac. And so many of those little things that still the sort of, you know, total disaster fallback situation is, oh, plug it into your Mac and restore it, or plug it into your Mac, suck off a backup, and then restore your device. That shouldn't be necessary. And I think if Apple were to just come out and say, okay, 2 years and that's it, everybody within Apple as well as outside Apple would have to just get on board this new train. And I think that would be to the great benefit of iOS if it just became a completely self-hosted platform. And that would also give you the impetus to do something like Xcode for iOS.
My local Mac reseller, Simply Mac, has an iMac that's like near their service desk that's simply for restoring iOS devices.
Yeah.
You know, failed upgrades, things like that, which, you know, I don't know. It's a problem for people more intelligent than me to figure out. But they are fun. It will be neat to see how these things evolve, because this is a time when Apple is facing its legacy products. And Apple historically has not, you know, on the Mac side, they'll cut stuff off. Like, we don't support that anymore. I mean, they, you know, with their you know, vintage and obsolete parts program, you know, they would just say, okay, we don't support that machine anymore for repairs. But they continue to sell iPods and, you know, as you should, Shuffles, Nanos, and Touches. So I don't know. We shall see.
Now, can make a case that Tim Cook's Apple has not been anything like aggressive enough at cutting things off. You know what I mean? Like, some of those old iPods, like, why is that still a product? You know, like, why is the iPod Nano still a product? You know, how many do they possibly sell? And, you know, there's a whole like alternate universe of software that Apple keeps going just to keep those devices selling, you know. Time to move everybody forward, I think.
Well, would Tim Cook's Apple keep the iPod Mini, have kept the iPod Mini around alongside the Nano?
Yes.
Yeah, I think he would have. And that, you know, I think that probably would have been the wrong decision. You could make an argument the fact that the iPad 2 hung around for so long. Wrong decision. Because if you think about what that did for developers on the iOS side, you know, that thing's only not been on the market for, what do you think, roughly a year?
Mm-hmm. But there's still hundreds of millions of them in the field.
There may be more than iPad 2s than anything.
Yeah, I'd be surprised, yeah.
But yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, where Steve would can products that sold well for Focus.
Yeah, and I think the iPad line is a classic example. I mean, the phone is different because the phone has such a high average selling price, you know, and it's so unaffordable for such a large proportion of the world that it is necessary to have a cheaper version, fair enough. But I think with the iPad line, not only has it been a boat anchor on progress for the platform, but it's also been incredibly confusing to users because, you know, you get people who, you know, buy an iPad 2 and they keep it around for years and they're like, well, Apple's still selling the iPad 2, so why should I upgrade or whatever? And you know, I'm just starting to see now people who've got iPad 2s start to get something newer than that. And I think Apple should have been a lot more aggressive at A, cutting the price of the new devices, and B, getting rid of the old ones. Because keeping the old one around, what that does is it lets you get fat on the high cost of the latest thing. And I think that we would be in a much better situation right now if Apple had aggressively cut the price of the newest iPads and not kept those old ones around.
You think about it, which of all the iPads they've sold, I mean, iPad 1, 2, iPad Air 2, iPad Pro, iPad Mini 1, to iPad Mini 4, they've only stopped selling, iPad 1?
iPad 1.
iPad 3. 2, iPad well, 3. Yeah, they just stopped selling iPad 2 with last year. iPad 3 and iPad 4 are no longer being sold.
Yep.
iPad Mini 1 is no longer being sold.
Yep. I suppose the Mini 3 technically as well, yeah.
I would make the argument that everything except iPad Air 2, iPad Pro, iPad Mini 4 should be cut.
Yeah, yeah. And if those products don't sell because they're too expensive, then they're too expensive and there needs to be some work done to get those costs down or take a smaller margin on them because, you know, it is what it is.
Well, I think they're trying to compete against the Kindle Fire line type price. I mean, they're trying to have a $199 type tablet.
Yeah, I mean, the iPad Mini is the gateway drug for children into iOS. The iPod Touch used to be.
You know, Steve's Apple, and I'm not in love with Steve's Apple that had its issues. I'm just more kind of contrasting. Steve's Apple would have said, we're going to focus and sell as much as we can of the products that we think are the best.
Yeah. And you saw how much more accessible the iPod line got over the years. That was, in some ways, that was the best that Apple's ever done at becoming the product for everyone. You know, when you saw the way the iPod price came down and down and down, whereas, you know, maintaining average selling price seems to be the goal for Apple right now. And I don't know that that's always to the benefit. The iPhone, yeah, the iPhone's always going to be a different story because of the subsidy model. But in the world of unsubsidized computer hardware, I think Apple has not been anything like aggressive enough in cutting the price of the iPad.
Let's thank our first sponsor of the night. This episode is sponsored by XMA, a leading Apple solution expert for education. As an Apple solution expert, XMA is perfectly positioned to support your institution with a deployment of iPad and Mac. They have built upon their 30 years of experience to create the unique All Learn program for iPad. With All Learn for iPad, XMA can help you with your planning, financing, and managing your iPad deployments. XMA can use their accredited trainers to deliver Apple professional development to teachers and staff to get the best results from your Apple products. Visit xma.co.uk to learn more about them, or you can follow them on Twitter at @wearexma to discover more about the All Learn program for iPad. Thanks to XMA for sponsoring the show this week. So in light of all our conversation, you had an interesting blog post.
I had an interesting week on the internet, that's true. Quite a good week, actually. You know, it was basically what it was on Monday I posted an article to my blog, which I talked to you about a little bit offline beforehand, which was very much inspired by a review that a Tesla owner wrote of a petrol car. And I thought that was kind of humorous way to look at the future and the past. And having been pretty frustrated by some of the ways in which people had written about the iPad Pro, in particular, so many journalists had written about the iPad Pro, really just with the underlying question of, is this thing a good thing to be a journalist with? I decided to write an article which was entitled, Can the MacBook Pro Replace Your iPad? And the basic premise of it was that to look at the iPad as being the default and normal device that you would use, and then contrasting all the shortcomings of the MacBook Pro by comparison, and sort of writing it in the style of doomsayer journalists who just are trying to pick apart every tiny little detail about the iPad and throw up against what you can normally do with a laptop. So I was saying things like, you know, well, it's crazy because, you know, you can't really use these things standing up. You've basically got to find a desk to sit there and do your computing, and that means you're limited in terms of the number of places you can do your computing and so on. And kind of just went on and on and on like that. And the response was phenomenal. It was very, very well received. You know, I got, hundreds of tweets with links to the post, and hundreds of app messages back and so on. Almost all of them very, very positive and finally, thankfully amusing, which is what I was kind of going for, but also realizing that there is a sort of shred of truth in the whole thing, that in fact, if the iPad had been invented first, it's not at all clear to me that these laptops would be as popular as they are. And that's kind of the way that I approached that. And Ben Baharin from TechPinions wanted to syndicate it, so we're syndicating it on his site as well. Got a link from Daring Fireball, various things like that. So really, quite possibly the most successful thing I've ever blogged, and I think I might as well just give up my blogging career at this point.
So I think probably one of your other most successful posts was when you proved that you didn't have to force quit apps for iOS multitasking.
Yes, that one still gets a lot of traction, although it probably shouldn't, because it's not strictly correct anymore because of changes in iOS 7 and iOS 8, but it's still to first order correct. So yeah, that was a good one too.
Yeah, I didn't realize you got a link from Dragon Fireball. That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that's the way to look at it. And I think you have to come to a computing platform understanding, like, what are my goals here? You know, what are the workflows I need to accomplish, and not start with the default. Mm-hmm. I think that's a healthy way to look at it. We like come to car. I mean, somebody would buy cars. Like, you say, okay, what do I want my car to do? I need to haul stuff. So I need a truck, or I need really good gas mileage. And because I commute a long way, so gas mileage is very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
You don't like the default isn't the truck, and then you have to convince yourself that the car would work.
Yeah, I think it's. I also felt that I just don't think people are critical enough of the computers they currently use. You know, I look at the Mac, and you know, tonight, Bradley, I just had this kind of technical failure with my Mac where it wouldn't record audio properly. You know, things like that. Having been so deeply immersed in iOS and how generally easy iOS is to use, I mean, it's got its own problems, but to first order, it's much more reliable and straightforward than any desktop computer. I've become much more demanding of my Mac, and I feel like I'm not getting what I need from that. But I think people are just too kind of uncritical about the Mac, and particularly, I don't want to bag on tech journalists, but they're very focused on their one workflow, which is I type things into the computer and then I post it into CMS. And if I can't do those two things, this computer sucks. Without having a broader view of all the kinds of things that people do with computers, and in fact, the kind of things that are now enabled by a pen-based iOS computer that are very, very difficult on the Mac. And this was part of, you know, the sort of satire that I was writing on the blog was, you know, today I was teaching and I had a Safari browser up on one side and split screen and I had Notability on the other, and I was doing some teaching alongside some content we were looking at on the web. And at just one point, I took a screenshot of that and I thought, I'm going to tweet this. And it just struck me again. Imagine I was trying to do this on the Mac. What a complete pain that would be, you know, to have like a tablet beside my Mac and have that all wired up and have a whole big sort of life support system built around me in the classroom, and instead I'm just standing there holding this tiny little slab of metal and glass and I'm just drawing on it and it's magically wirelessly appearing on the screen in front of me. That is, you know, that is just another kind of moment where I'm thinking, this is actually much better. It's not just it can keep up with the Mac, it's actually this has gone beyond what was possible with the Mac.
It's like when, you know, laptops came sort of mainstream. Mm. And they were, by all measures, worse computers. They had batteries that didn't last very long. The computers were not there. They were portable, but not super mobile. They were slow.
They were a fraction of the performance of the desktop.
Yeah, fraction, expensive, but didn't matter because what they gained outweighed the negatives.
Yeah.
And the people that wanted laptops didn't care about the other things. And I think it's along that same vein that iPad enables things that were not feasible before. It's particularly work that is not done sitting at a desk in a cubicle for 8 hours. Like, again, you have to come to it from a place of, what am I looking for these machines to do? And again, if you are the type of person that writes in Xcode, or if you have to write in a custom CMS that works terrible on iOS, sure, you probably should use a Mac.
Mm-hmm.
But that shouldn't be the assumption. The assumption should be, well, how will I be using this? Will I be mobile? Will I, like if you're the type of person that use technology, but there are also other things that you do. I mean, I think about like POS systems in retail shops. I mean, those have largely been computer-based for years. They are all terrible. Yes. Those are places where like iPad has the ability to completely revolutionize how that is done. And it's still computing. It's just, again, it's like it's better suited for the task. And you always have to look at, like, what's the best tool for the task? You know, they're tools at the end of the day.
I think the thing that is disturbing to some people, Bradley, is the idea that there are tasks that used to be absolutely commonplace on computers that are starting to go away, like that people just don't care about anymore. And one big example is word processing. I think word processing is rapidly going away. And not to say it's going away everywhere, but the idea that you have to be using a virtual piece of paper to type out your data on is something that is going away. You know, the fact that text and writing on the computer is becoming decoupled from paper is, I think, a good thing, but it is happening. You know, people don't necessarily care about spreadsheets anymore. Certainly nobody cares about databases on the desktop. That is a dead topic in terms of like a literal, I'm building a relational database solution on the desktop for something. And nobody's doing that anymore. You know, and you can see that because on modern platforms, there simply don't exist products that do that kind of thing. There is no Microsoft Access on iOS because who wants it, right? Sure, you've got database-like apps. You know, OmniFocus is a database. Day One is a database. Everything's a database underneath, but nobody's sitting down defining fields and types and relations and things like that on the desktop in the way that they used to. That's all gone.
Well, they're using Salesforce and tools like that for it.
Oh, it's all gone online. Absolutely. You're right. You know, that's where people interact with the database now.
Yeah. Well, they're using more specific, you know, cloud providers have come along to create customized versions of that. And again, yeah, you have apps that talk to hosted databases.
So Benedict Evans line, he says that every template in Excel should be a SaaS product. You know, every expense tracker, every debt consolidation spreadsheet, every recipe manager, they could all be separate SaaS products.
Well, I think about like the app that's killed, like even Numbers for me. Like I don't even have Numbers installed anywhere on any of my computers. If I have to open up a Numbers file, I open it up on iCloud.com.
Yeah.
I'm on this like mission to use as little space as possible on my Mac. I use Solver.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple type calculations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's things that probably, again, 5 years ago I would use Excel for.
Yep.
And in word processing, I mean, if you think about it, word processing was always built to print.
Yeah.
And we're not printing as much. And things like understanding, I mean, I'm not saying that like Markdown is something that all kids should know, but like I think more relevant that they know how to do that for their careers. And like if you have someone that says, hey, I want to be like a journalist one day, like what do you think is more applicable with them to learn? HTML and Markdown or Word?
Shorthand. Yeah. No, I completely take your point, Bradley. And I think work is changing. And it's changing more rapidly than people, A, would like and, B, are comfortable with. And I think that, you know, when you play an alternate reality game like I was in my blog, I think you start to see that actually, for people who have grown up with mobile devices, and I don't just mean iOS or iPad, but just, you know, any smartphone in general, the fact that, you know, constant connectivity is now a thing, and SaaS is a thing, and cloud is a thing, the way that people approach the job to be done is starting to radically change. And I think, you know, the idea that I'm writing about on iOS is kind of where that goes in the end. And I'm sort of almost writing, I try to put myself in the shoes of somebody who might have graduated from our school and they're going to university and they're like, should I get a laptop? What's the point in that? Let's maybe get an iPad Pro instead.
Before we move on, let's thank our next sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Squarespace. You guys know Squarespace. This is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own website. Start your free trial today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code PUPIL to get 10% off your first purchase. Starts at just $8 a month, and you get a free domain name the first year if you sign up for a year. I registered another Squarespace site this week. Not kidding. I literally have 12 now, so I have one a month that renews. It's a constant rotation to have them all managed in one account for another website I created. It's trusted by millions of people, and some of the most respected brands in the world use Squarespace. Squarespace has state-of-the-art technology powering your site to ensure security and stability. If you want to be on the web, you want to create a website for your baseball team, for your church organization, for your school, for your club, to me, you start with Squarespace. That's the fast and easy place to get started. Sites look professional. They're responsive with no coding required. But if you want to code, you can insert JavaScript and you can do all the fun stuff. Has drag and drop and intuitive and easy to use tools. I cannot recommend Squarespace enough. Have multiple websites that I use with it. We're looking at moving our church's website to Squarespace as well. To me, it's the default platform for websites in 2015. So again, go to squarespace.com, use the offer code PUPIL, when you check out to get 10% off, and that lets Squarespace know that you came to them from our show. 30 minutes into the show, we kind of on our real main topic of the night. So I want to give the listeners kind of a state of the union where we're at. So we're going to have a show today, which we've had half of that, and we're going to spend the next a little bit talking about the history of iPad deployment. And I think that is helpful for a number of reasons. Number one, to laugh at the past and to know how hard it was. And number two, to also acknowledge how far Apple has come in 5 years. Mm-hmm. I think it was particularly around this time last year, you and I were both very, very frustrated with Apple mm-hmm. from just the entire iOS platform in general, from a software stability, from deployment. We were very frustrated. And I think it's largely changed this year. And I'm very, very positive right now. And we got a number of changes this year with MDM. And so I think it's just helpful to step back and say, Apple has done a good job over the past 5 years over making iPad deployments fairly seamless and really, really easy. I think the line I used to you earlier, Fraser, over text was, they have eliminated all of the gotchas that I've seen. So like on our deployment series in 2014, there were plenty of places where we said, well, this is a pain point and we don't have a good solution here. Here's what you might do. And I think in 2015, heading into deployments in fall of 2016, which you should be planning for now, those things are gone. And like there are answers to your questions and there are solutions to your problems. And I think that is an amazing place to be in 5 years.
Yeah. Couldn't agree with you more. I think, I was at an Apple event yesterday. I was actually speaking at it in Edinburgh, and we were having dinner afterwards, and the guy I was sitting next to, he said, you know, we were talking about what I was doing at school, and he said, you know, so how's your work-life balance? And after I stopped laughing, I said to him, you know, one of the things that has actually improved that dramatically over the past 5 years is just how much better the deployment tools have got for iOS. Because 5 years ago, when we started our one-to-one project, the number of sheer hours I spent, plugging iPads into Macs and syncing on iTunes and downloading apps to multiple different stations across the school and so on and so on and so on, I just simply do not spend that kind of time anymore. And that has freed me to do other things in the school, which I'm responsible for as well. So it's noticeable how far it's come. And a big step for us was getting involved in NDM. But there have been benefits all the way along. And I think the other reason for doing this little bit of the show, Bradley, is to help people appreciate the reasons why things are the way they are now. So overall, I think, you know, we are in a much better position. And one of the reasons why I wanted to do this part of the show was to kind of help people understand why things are the way they are today. Because sometimes if you come to iOS deployment cold, you think this is complicated, it's convoluted, it's complex, why is it the way it is? And I think just understanding where we've come from helps to explain a lot of the reasons why things are as they are just now.
So we'll probably spend the rest of the show covering history. Next week, we're going to talk about deployment documentation. I doubt we'll get to that today, but we might. And then we are going to set up and talk about our January kickoff of deployment 2016. I joked about that last week, but after Fraser and I talked and talked to some others, we felt it would be helpful to do that show again, or that series again, because a lot of things have changed. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our opinions on things have changed. I mean, that would have been 2 years since then. Yep. So a lot has changed in iOS deployment. And we've covered a lot of that since then. But I think it would be helpful for new listeners, for existing listeners, and hopefully new listeners, to have a place, a foundation. If you're planning a deployment in 2016, let's walk through that and see what that looks like now that we have device enrollment really, you know, largely deployed around the world, not everywhere, but in a lot of places. It's not like U.S. only like it used to be. Mm-hmm. And then device-based app assignment, just lots of new stuff and things that the iPad line has brought through multitasking and picture-in-picture and things like that can largely control or, you know, influence what devices we pick. Mm-hmm. So looking forward to that. That'll be kicked off in 2016.
Yeah. So the history of deployment on iOS, Bradley, goes back to, well, I think maybe what we should do is we should basically talk about from in the iPad era, 2010 and onwards. There were some earlier things that happened as well. I mean, the first tool that we started off with was, apart from iTunes, was a thing called iPhone Configuration Utility, which was a very, very bare-bones precursor to what we know today as Apple Configurator. So we had configuration profiles back then, and although they weren't able to control as many things on iOS, and quite frankly, there weren't as many things to control in iOS back then as there are now, the idea of configuration profiles is essentially unchanged from the days in which we were plugging in iPhone Configuration Utility and putting things on our iPads. So that was kind of our first deployment model. Was every classroom had an iMac, and that class, they were individualized iPads, but the children in that classroom, they would sync their iPads to the Mac in that classroom. And that Mac was running iTunes, and they would get the new apps that were downloaded to the Mac, and that was how app distribution was done, is we would download the apps to the Mac and then sync them out over USB to the devices. And that was about all you could do in those days. And it did work. Don't get me wrong, it did work, but it was complicated.
Well, and one thing, it really was a bad deal for developers at the time, because there was no volume purchase program.
Yeah.
And so, like, if you had, like, 100 iPads, there was no limit. I mean, while the limit on number of computers that could be tied to an iTunes account was mm-hmm. 5, there was no number that I have ever found of iPads or yeah. iOS devices. So you could buy a $1 app, sync it to 100 iPads.
Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, we did, because that was all you could possibly do.
I mean, other than, like, the only way you could have somehow done it would be to have, like, a Mac per iPad.
Yeah.
And it's just, and when you talk to Apple, like, they would tell you, yeah, you just need to buy one. We talk about, like, App Store economics. That was a bad deal for developers.
Well, some people at Apple would tell you that, and other people would tell you, no, you have to buy one for every device, and then you ask them how you're supposed to do that, and they say, actually, there's no good way, but you still have to do it. And true story, the first contact I ever had from Apple about our iPad one-to-one project was when somebody came to tell me that what I had written in my blog was a violation of the terms and conditions of the App Store. And I was like, yeah, okay, so As soon as you give me a way to buy 100 copies, I'll buy 100 copies. But there is absolutely no way that I am creating 100 different Apple IDs and logging in and out on iTunes just so I can buy it multiple times. Because not only would the App Store lock me out for that, but also the credit card would certainly get blocked by the credit card company as well. So, you know, the doctrinaire line, the terms and conditions line was, yes, you should buy the number of users or the number of devices, whichever is fewer. But there was no practical way to actually do that until we got volume purchase. So that was how we did it. And we did it through three different Apple IDs because we had so many classrooms. And you're saying, the number of Macs per account was five. We had one account for the junior school and two accounts for the senior school. And that was how we got to the right number. So we would buy three copies of an app and we would sync it out over USB to all the iPads in the school.
Well, and one thing to remember, when we did not get Exchange support in iOS until iOS 2, and that, I think, in hindsight, is one of the big factors of the success in iOS in the workplace, not necessarily in education, but in the workplace. With iOS 1, you could sync Exchange over IMAP, but a lot of Exchange administrators block that for security reasons. And many people never thought Apple would license ActiveSync from Microsoft. I remember when Steve Jobs announced that people cheered. This allowed C-level employees to buy their iPhones, hand over their IT department, say, make this work with my Exchange email. And if it wasn't for that Exchange support, there wasn't a lot of good ways. It certainly wasn't a way to get calendar and contacts on there. And so that, I think, in hindsight, I guess that was in 2008, was huge for the iOS. And certainly that was on the original iPad as well.
Yeah, I was actually at WWDC that year. I think it was the last one I've been at. And it was super obvious in the keynote there. That was when the iPhone 3G came out. And it was super obvious in the iOS 2 presentation that someone had gone to a lot of businesses and they had just sat in a room and listened to and written down all the reasons people were giving for why they weren't buying iPhones for the company. And then they took that list back to Cupertino and they just implemented every single thing that people had said to them at that point. ActiveSync was obviously a huge one. Various other security, passcodes, things like that. Lots and lots of different security features. VPN stuff, different things like that. And all of that was just knocked off one by one. And to be fair to Apple, over the years, they have basically done that. You know, it doesn't support Cisco VPN. Okay, we'll fix that, and so on and so on. So, yeah, I think that one of the stories of iOS, apart from the deployment technologies, has been that the core operating system has just been through a process of getting all the features that people have said, we're not buying iOS because, and whatever it was.
Before we move on, let's thank our last sponsor of the night. It's the great folks at Jamf Software. You guys know Jamf. They provide IT staff with great tools to power Apple products in your schools and your workplaces. iPhones, Apple TVs, iPads, Macs, anything you got from Apple, they'll manage it. They have a great app called Casper Focus, which allows teachers from their iPad to take control of their classrooms. They can choose and distribute iBooks, initiate AirPlay, get a student's attention. Lots of great stuff. It allows them to do it from their iPad. It doesn't require the IT department. So if you manage Apple products at your school or your workplace and you don't have a mobile device management system, Fraser and I both pay for Jamf. We love it. Use it this week to very quickly do something, and it always appears like magic. Learn more about the Casper Suite, Casper Focus, and Jamf Software at jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. So iPad 2, which to me, I still remember where I was at when I first heard of iPad 2. I was at another school doing a visit and checking in, and I realized they had launched an app alongside iPad 2 called Apple Configurator, which now, correct my history, had the volume purchase program already launched before Apple Configurator?
No, I think they came at the same time, or VPP came soon after, at least in the US, because the thing that was tricky about Configurator, or the thing that Configurator did, was, you know, we just discussed that iTunes would never enforce the App Store terms and conditions. It would just basically let you sync N copies of any app that you had bought to any number of devices. Well, Configurator was the tool that would actually technically enforce the terms and conditions. So you had to download a code of coupon codes in a spreadsheet, install that spreadsheet into Apple Configurator along with the app binary, and then it would count down the number of licenses that you had every time you added one to another iPad. So that was the two things kind of came along side by side.
Yeah, it's, as you said, it largely solved that question of how we mass buy apps. Now, it was not great in the beginning. See, the way it worked, too, is you had the spreadsheet, which was oddly enough an Excel spreadsheet and not a number spreadsheet, and still to this day is an Excel spreadsheet.
That's because SAP doesn't have a numbers generator component in it.
The way that spreadsheet looks is it has like links that you can, and the idea of that was is you can like say email these links out to people mm-hmm. if you're like and they have the codes embedded in the links, and you can copy. You have to copy one of those codes. This is all, I believe, pre-configurator too. You had to copy one of these codes, go redeem it in iTunes, mm-hmm. download the binary, and then add that app to Configurator. By default, it was supposed, then it would ask you for your spreadsheet. Okay. Mm-hmm. By default, it was supposed to basically give you an extra license. So if you bought 20 copies, you actually had to redeem one of them to get it. So you only had 19 codes left. But the program was designed to basically give you one. Mm-hmm. It never worked. And so your options were to either like get on the phone with Apple Enterprise Support and they would somehow like give you a code or something. And that was one thing to remember too is, and I appreciate that, is you did not call AppleCare for Configurator issues. You called Apple Enterprise Support and they would, remote in and fix it. And it was nice. So what I got in the habit of doing, because it wasn't worth me calling someone to say, like if it was a $2 app, it wasn't worth me calling someone to say $2. Mm-hmm. I would just, if I need 20 copies, I would just buy like 24.
Yeah.
And just, I know you're probably like losing a little bit of money, but to me, I saved it in time. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I still do that. I don't know why. I just like, if I need 20, I buy 22, 23. They're usually fairly cheap. Yeah. And especially even a $10 app, if you get it at 50%, cost $5, saving $10 to save me an hour on the phone with Apple Support getting a code fixed. Mm-hmm. Money well spent. Yeah. And so that was kind of how you did it. And it also, Configurator introduced for the first time the idea of supervising the iPads. So this was like the first time these iPads were not the user is king mentality. Because prior to that, you had very little ways to actually lock down devices. And so supervision was brought along with Apple Configurator 1.
Yeah, so up to this point, the only thing you could do is basically turn on parental controls one by one on the device. And with the introduction of supervision, this was the first time where there started to be like two paths for the life of an iOS device. The first one being a personally owned, personally managed with a little bit of configuration laid on top by the admin people. And then there's now this other path, which was this device was bought by the institution. We're deploying them professionally, in a centralized fashion. And we're configuring them, and then we're handing them to the users. And that was the beginning of a kind of institutional deployment model. And supervision has always had this interesting property whereby it's like a big lever that you throw, because it requires that in order to supervise a device, you have to wipe it first. And that's always been the kind of guard against sysadmins trying to take over a user's device by supervising it. Schools still find themselves in the kind of forked stick of this problem, which is that if you have a BYOD situation, but you also want to, say, disable iMessage and FaceTime on those devices, but you don't own the device comes into school pre-configured, and you want to do some supervised-only configuration on that, well, you can't do it because you can't just blow away somebody's iPad. So it was the start, I think, of a push that Apple made and then kind of pulled back from, to get people to do institutional deployments of iPads. And it's to the detriment, I think, that they haven't actually kept that push going.
That's always been the term I've heard, is the user is king. And, even to this day, I have a buddy that works at a large organization in downtown Chattanooga, and he still has the unlimited AT&T. And he says, I still use 10 gigs a month. I'm like, how? He says, because I don't join our corporate Wi-Fi network because it basically makes you sign your life away with security protocols. Like they, you know, that's the other way organizations are getting around it. You're installing tons of certificates to even log on the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I mean, a configurator did actually save us a lot of time, because the other thing that configurator brought that we couldn't do before was you could not update the operating system on more than one device at once. So if you plugged in a USB hub and seven iPads into a Mac, you could synchronize multiple at once. I remember very well seeing, you know, seven or eight devices, up to 14 devices I did at times, synchronizing app installations and backups of multiple iPads at once. But iTunes could only ever update the software, update the operating system on one device at one time. And the one thing that Configurator did do that was great was you could plug in as many iPads as your USB chain would support, and you could update iOS on all of them at the same time. And that alone was transformational.
Well, and that's where Apple, they sold those big Bretford carts that they still sell that have those really high-powered USB hubs. Because that's one of the caveats. Like, I have a 12-port Anchor, but I will only plug in usually about six or seven at a time, because iPads draw a decent amount of power. And so you don't want to, like, kind of short out your hub and things lose connection and are flaky. You don't want to deal with that.
Well, we certainly burned through several of those hubs over the years. Yeah.
I want to err on the side of, like, updating less at a time through Configurator than, like, having them flake out. Because the time I would take having to restore something, I lost my efficiency there.
Yeah, I think we all, you know, those of us who have used Configurator for a long time have sort of lost our nerve a little bit on mass updating of iOS devices. You know, I used to gaily plug in 7 or 14 at a time and just hit go, and then you would have like, oh, four have just lost their configuration. And now I'm very much in the same camp as you. I'm like, here's two. Okay, let's plug in one more.
That's like, okay, four's good, four's good. Okay, good. Well, and we have to remember, all of this is built upon the iTunes like licensing system.
Yeah.
Still. I mean, it's like you're having to authenticate with an Apple ID. You know, it's a little bit different with Configurator too, but like that's still, and that's why I kind of always gave Configurator a pass in the beginning, because I knew how difficult a problem they were trying to solve.
Yeah, yeah, and it was very clear always to me that the people who were doing Configurator were neither very close to the App Store people nor very close to the iOS people. And they were sort of trying to bridge the gap between these two worlds in a way that neither end of that gap really cared to have it bridged. And Configurator had some weird stuff as well. Like, they had this checkout model that you used to be able to do, where you could sort of notionally check out a device to a person and then check it back in. And Configurator would sort of suck all the data off that device and then reset it, and then you could restore somebody else's. So it was kind of like a personalized backup and restore system. But that never really worked properly, and I have heard from little birdies that nobody on the iOS team particularly cared to actually make that easy for the people who were doing Configurator. So it was that was a feature that sort of, you know, if they had put all the wood behind that feature, that could have actually been really good. But the problem was that over time, it was great when all you did on the iPad was make a couple of Keynote files, because you could suck off all that data in about a few minutes and then restore it in a few minutes. But once people started really making stuff on iPads, it just became an intractable amount of data to pull off and put back on over USB in any reasonable short period of time. So that was a feature. I think that feature is actually gone now, from recent versions of Configurator 1.x.
Yes, I believe that's the case.
Yeah.
So we, you know, that was where we were at, and we kind of muddled along. Then we got integration with VPP and mobile device management systems. And it, you know, over the years, Apple, you know, when they started really pushing MDMs, it was clear that was going to be the future model of iOS management.
Yeah.
And so, you know, originally, like, app deployment through VPP and MDM, you just lost the license. Like, you pushed it and you were done. Like, you know, and so that had the negative, that had the simplicity of over-the-air deployments, but it had the added cost. And so you know, sysadmins had to make the decision. Do I want simple deployment or do I want to rebuy apps every year? Because you would have to do that. Like, so if you bought, you know, 300 copies of Pages for your 300 person iPad deployment and you pushed it out over your MDM, you would then have to buy 300 copies every single year.
Yeah. Because you were essentially doing a model where you were automating the process of sending a coupon to every person who had a device. And all when that coupon arrived at the device, it would be redeemed in the App Store, i.e. burned. And the user whose Apple ID was active on that device would have that license transferred to them. And that was never revocable again. Even with Configurator, although you were doing the same thing with codes, Configurator knew the serial numbers it had put those apps on, and it knew that it could take them back as well. Whereas with managed distribution or VPP codes into MDM, that's not quite managed distribution, that's still coupon codes. But putting the coupon codes in your MDM and pushing them out over the air, you're right, you got the over-the-air push, but you lost the code. And that was kind of like, well, you know, between the devil and the deep blue sea, do I want to have to bring everything back to base and plug it in just to keep my licenses, or do I want to eat the cost of those licenses in order to not have to bring those devices back to base in order to get new apps? And it was the worst of both worlds on both sides, I suppose, until we got the so-called managed distribution feature, which was, with iOS 8, allowed us to put... basically what it brought, Bradley, was it brought the ability for your MDM server to talk directly to the store, know about your account, and pull down from the store your purchase history and the number of licenses and the apps that you had bought, and bring it all and ingest that all into your MDM directly. And then from there, you could assign those licenses to Apple IDs, not to devices. Right, so that was kind of the difference with managed distribution, was that you were assigning the apps to people, not to devices. And that meant, for example, that if you had a staff member who had their iPad enrolled in your MDM and you assigned their Apple ID and app, they could also find that on their phone and download it if the phone was on the same Apple ID.
Yeah, and this is helpful if you've got an expensive application that you only need in a class for a certain period of time. You can basically check it out, check it back in.
Yep. Yep. And this was one of the things that this was where we started to get this hard requirement for having an Apple ID. Because if you want to do this, you've got to have an Apple ID running on every device so that you can assign the app to the Apple ID. And then as a sort of consequence, the device can install the app. And in many ways, we've actually started to roll back from that with this new device-based distribution, is that it's a kind of almost a step back to the old way, but it's better than the old way, but in the sense that you don't have to have an Apple ID active on the device. You can just send the app to the device directly.
It's the best of both worlds. Yeah, because the Apple ID requirement was particularly difficult for two reasons. Number one, it just was difficult to communicate that to parents, like, hey, you have to have an Apple ID. Mm-hmm. Like, well, I already have one. Do they use mine? Do they make their own? Like, it was complex. And, you know, and then you had situations where it was kids under 13. Apple had this whole program where the parents had to make it. And it was again, complex. And so with this device-based app assignment, which is new with iOS 9, this is a very new thing. It has eliminated that. So kids don't have to have Apple IDs on their devices. If they have them, that's fine. But, like, you can run your school deployment without requiring them to have one. Now, you do miss things like iCloud backup and ability to sync files to other devices, but you at least can push apps.
Yeah. The big thing you do lose, though, is you lose the ability to use iTunes U. And that is a showstopper, at least in secondary schools, if not in primary schools, because you need an Apple ID to enroll in an iTunes U course. So, therefore, you still need an Apple ID. But at least it's taken the problem above the apps, and now it's a problem about access to services without an Apple ID, which you can't get. But, yeah, overall, VPP managed distribution has been a revelation. If you can get through the process of making Apple IDs for everybody who's got a device in your school. And I remember one summer I just sat and made 50 or 60 Apple IDs in one go. Professional tip, I used Keyboard Maestro to make a macro that would type it all in for me and page through all the pages in iTunes that made it work. So that is something you might want to consider if you have to do that. But managed distribution has overall been a huge, huge win for iOS deployment. It's probably been the most important thing that's ever happened.
And if you're going to do that, you need to get your Apple SE to whitelist your IP address for a period of time.
Yep.
But again, with device-based app assignment, you don't. If you just need apps to appear, you don't have to do that anymore.
No.
So, nope. Last thing is the Device Enrollment Program DEP. Mm-hmm. And so, what this is you get your school set up with Apple, and it talks, the device enrollment program talks directly with your mobile device manager system. So again, this can be the Casper suite. This can even be a profile manager. So I talked to my Apple SE and I said, is anybody really using that anymore? And kind of, you know, chuckled, not really. And, you know, this just, I just don't, most people are going to go with a more robust one. Casper suite, either hosted on site, AirWatch, you know, many, many others. And it's important to note that all of the MDM providers are only allowed to do what Apple has APIs for. The secret sauce is in how they can present data and then how they can group devices.
Yeah.
So from a feature standpoint, they're all doing the same thing, assuming they are up to the latest APIs that Apple allows.
More or less. I was at an event recently with one of our Apple SEs, and they were saying that it's surprising actually how many MDMs don't support certain features that the MDM protocol can do on iOS. And there is actually more of a variation than you might think in terms of all the things that can be done. But you're right. I think the key thing actually is what the workflow is to get your job done with the MDM that you choose. And it's much more about that and the, you know, the data analysis that you can do and the notifications you can get of what's happening in your MDM rather than necessarily, I can set all the flags or whatever.
Well, and I, one tip, and we'll talk about this more in the deployment series, is if your reseller, whether it be Apple or a reseller, like if you're in the UK, sells an MDM, roll it into your lease. Mm-hmm. That's going to make it just, you know, it's just like everything else. Just make it part of your lease and say, okay, this is just an extra cost or lease as our management system. Just build it in. If it wasn't a requirement in 2014, it's certainly a requirement to have a management system in 2016.
Well, I think really when the advent of managed distribution, Bradley, that was when MDMs became something that everybody had to have. And the fact the success of the free Meraki version has kind of proven how much people had to get on board with MDM, even though they hadn't planned for the budget for it, perhaps. So I think that overall, device enrollment is a very, very interesting thing because it kind of gets us to the point. Device enrollment is all about putting zeros on the end of an iOS deployment. So where I, in 2010, I was able to do 100, and I'm fairly certain I couldn't have scaled much beyond that. When Apple Configurator came along, we could do maybe 200, 300 at a push, maybe up to 500 if we had a lot of stations. Device enrollment program and managed distribution is about taking that up to multiple tens of thousands. And I firmly believe that we can scale iOS deployments up to that size now. Three big things that device enrollment really brings. Number one, supervision over the air. That's one of the things that you were never able to do before, even with managed distribution, which you always had to plug your device into Configurator to supervise it in the first place. The second thing you get with DEP is enforced enrollment in your MDM. So that for years and years, the problem or the trick with MDM has been that you can put an MDM profile on a device, but you cannot enforce that profile stays there. And that's been a user is king decision by Apple over the years, and it's been controversial and difficult for schools in quite a lot of the time. But with device enrollment, they will now allow you to enforce MDM enrollment through the setup assistant. So as soon as you set up a device, it will enroll in your MDM. So it can never be out of management from your device.
Well, it's one thing to note that BYOD deployments cannot add like student-owned devices to their DEP profile. They have to be purchased from Apple or a reseller that supports DEP.
Yeah. So they talk about this chain of custody from the Apple factory to you. And the only way to get enrolled in DEP is to do it through a purchase order. There is another way you can backfill some inventory, but it's very difficult and it's probably not worth your time to do it. So what you get with DEP is as soon as you buy the devices and the serial numbers are allocated, even before the devices are manufactured, as I believe is possible, those serial numbers can be associated with your DEP account. And they can actually, before those products actually appear at your door, you can start applying configuration to them because they will be visible in your MDM, which is super cool, I think. And you can effectively get to a point where you can have zero-touch device configuration from breaking the shrink wrap on the box to the devices configured on the Wi-Fi, enrolled in your MDM, assigned to a user and apps are starting to install on that device. And that's kind of the holy grail of iOS deployment, is that I never want to, with my hands, touch a device. Now, my ambition for the past deployment that we've done, the last 2.5 years, has been that I wanted to configure those devices in 2013, and I never wanted to see those devices back in my hands unless they were broken. And I actually have achieved that, which I think is really cool. I'm very pleased with that, that there are some devices in our school that I have not touched since 2013, because they haven't broken, they haven't had a software problem, and I haven't had to touch them to do anything to them. I've changed their configuration, I've installed apps on them, but I haven't personally handled them or touched them. And that is a huge step forward. And I think DEP, just what that's going to do is it's going to cut out that, you know, week and a half that I spend in the summer where I'm cutting the shrink wrap on every box and putting them in the case and so on and so on. And hopefully what we'll be able to do is we'll just have the stack of shrink wrap boxes and we'll just start opening them up and taking them out in front of the students. Maybe I'll just be there to make sure they go in a case before we hand them over. But that's my ambition for the next stage, is to cut that setup time at the start of the deployment down to as little as I can, if not hopefully zero as well.
Well, and you know, you could even see the model where you hand student shrink wrap devices and a case in a box and say, go home. And as soon as they get on their Wi-Fi at home, everything's going to happen.
Yeah.
Apps will download. I mean, doesn't, you know, these things aren't, you know, this part of the setup process will be enrolling in your MDM on boot up. And so it can happen anywhere.
Yes, it can, on any network. That is the reason it's not completely zero touch just yet is because you still have to at least pick a Wi-Fi network and authenticate to it in order to obviously connect to the Apple activation server and then be redirected to your MDM and then talk to that service and get stuff sorted out. So it's I'm really optimistic, actually. I you know, this has been out for a couple of years, so it's starting to get very stable, and people I've talked to that have used it have said that it does what it's advertised to do. The only tricky thing in recent times has been if you have a device repaired, there can sometimes be a bit of a delay when a new device that's been assigned to you gets put into your DEP account. But that's apparently, they announced at WWDC that time is going to be cut from whatever it was, like 48 hours or something, to 4 hours after the Apple Store replaces the device for you. So that's going to be a nice improvement too.
Oh, absolutely. It has come a long way. So we've kind of gone through this, you know, history a little bit, and it is kind of crazy to think, like, I feel like we have finally arrived to where no more gotchas or no more, yeah, that stinks, hope they fix that in the future, have fun with that.
Yeah, no, I think there's not that many things I can think of where it's like, oh, you just can't have that on iOS now. You know, you can't have a VPN and use iOS, or you can't have, you know, a captive portal on your Wi-Fi and or iOS won't work with it. That's more reserved now for things like Apple TV, which there are still gotchas on Apple TV, let's say, but not so much on iOS. And I think more and more you're just looking at this as being another computer that comes out of the box. And I think this is one of the things where, okay, Macs do this as well, but the imaging process, the setup process is starting to really mature. And as long as you, the thing that I've always found with sysadmins in schools in particular is that as soon as they think they've found a way around the way Apple wants you to do it, that's when I'm thinking, okay, I've got to back away from this because this is going to blow up at some point. And that's always a red flag to me, is when somebody tells me, oh, I've figured out how to get around, you know, Apple IDs or something like that. I'm just like, oh my goodness, what, you know, that might work this year, but next year that's going to blow up, or 2 years it's going to blow up or something like that. And I've always been very keen personally to try and, as close as I can, try and follow the guidelines that Apple has put down. And because I've done that over 5 years, I have not had a situation where my deployment has blown up at any point. It's always worked. It's always been supported. We've not had many surprises. There's been a few, and mostly they've been to do with bugs. Bugs in iOS 7, bugs in iOS 8 particularly. Those have been the times when I've been under real stress and pressure to get things back working, but not because I thought I was doing this, and then Apple shut a door that I had, or closed a loophole that I had somehow worked my way through. And I strongly encourage people to do that. I think that's the right thing to do. And next week, Bradley, I think what we'll do is we'll talk through, well, how do you know what Apple recommends you to do? There's actually a lot of documentation about that, but I think it's probably worth us summarizing what those documents are about and telling people where to go for that kind of technical low-level information.
Yeah, be fun. And then we'll take 2 weeks off for Christmas and be back in January with our deployment 2016 kickoff. So thanks to everybody for listening today. If you have a moment, go to iTunes and rate us. That would be great. It's itunes.com/out of school. We also have a feedback form at outofschool.net. So if you have questions, have comments, you can get in contact with us then. If you have a app or a product and you want to consider sponsoring the show, you can get in touch with us there, and we can discuss how to get in front of the best-looking audience on the internet, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And again, thanks to everybody for listening. I kind of don't say this enough, but it still amazes me that anyone would listen to anything I have to say. So regardless of how many shows you listen to, or if you only listen to half of one, I know Fraser does as well, really, really appreciate it. We love doing this show, and when we hear feedback from people like, hey, this really helped me out, like, that makes it all worth it. So, thanks for letting us kind of come into your car, come into your workout, and talk for an hour each week into your ears.
Yep. Our whole thing, Bradley, I always feel is I just want to make deployments work better in schools. And if we can do that through our own experience or through things we've seen and heard in other schools, or just pointing out the gotchas that still do exist in some areas of this whole game, that's what I want to do. I want to save people from pain.
So that's it for this week. Thanks to our sponsors, Jamf, XMA, and Squarespace. And we'll have all links to everything we talked about and to our sponsors in the show notes at outofschool.net and or in your podcast app of choice. Have a good week, everybody. Dum 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 dum. I wonder if Fraser will edit this out. Dum 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 dum. So I hummed a song to a show, and when you're editing it, if you can tell me the name of that song, you get an immediate citizenship.